Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. This is Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Today, it's all ducky on For the People as we open, inviting you to have a blast while supporting dozens of worthy nonprofits at the 20th anniversary Duck Race and Festival. It's all coming up Sunday, June 1st in downtown Naugatuck, and we're going to have a representative inviting you to join thousands of attendees as more than 15,000 rubber ducks are launched into the Naugatuck River, along with other fun festivities, vendors, games, and live entertainment. Then we're going to get serious as we pick up the conversation about domestic and family violence prevention with the CEO from the Domestic Violence Crisis Center. We'll also invite you to support the cause at their upcoming Voices of Courage luncheon. And then we're going to close delivering you a little culture, literally, as we meet the co-founder of Cardi, a nonprofit mobile art museum bus bridging inequalities in education and arts access by partnering with local community organizations across the region to provide families and children with exciting art and museum adventures. But first, we want to remind you that the Connecticut Insurance Department has scheduled a public information meeting of the Severe Weather Mitigation and Resiliency Advisory Council. It's coming up on Thursday, May 8th, starting at 10:30 at their headquarters at 153 Market Street in Hartford. The public is encouraged to attend and provide input on the Advisory Council's ongoing efforts to strengthen Connecticut's resilience to climate-related risks. The informational meeting is going to begin with updates from members of the council, followed by presentations, and then the meeting's going to open for public comment with time reserved for individuals who've signed up in advance to speak. If you'd like to get all the details and all the information you need to participate or to learn more, just visit the Connecticut Insurance Department at portal.ct.gov/CID. All right. Yes, as we said in the introduction, it's all ducky here during segment one of the award-winning For the People here, our last show of the month of April, and appropriately introducing you to one of Western Connecticut's biggest events coming up the very first day of June, Sunday, June 1st. That is the fantastic Duck Race and Festival 20th anniversary coming to downtown Naugatuck. And I've got Barbara Sarosiak on the line. She's representing the Naugatuck Chamber and is a chamber professional working with a number of different organizations. So very glad to have Barbara on board this morning to tell us about all the excitement, but also to give us a little bit of education. Barbara, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, John. Thanks for having me.
So as we were chatting a little bit before we turned on the mic, you've been in event management for quite a while, although I'm not sure an event of this size and scope is ever easy, and it's certainly never the same no matter how many years you do it. As we like to say here, the planning for next year starts the day it's over, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So let's start this chat from a little bit of a different perspective, because I think when a lot of people who aren't members of chambers or business owners hear about chambers of commerce, their automatic assumption is, well, isn't this organization designed to go out and support and help businesses and do ribbon cuttings and to promote the recruitment and retention of businesses and communities? But in fact, an event like this that brings thousands and thousands of people into the borough of Naugatuck is actually a spectacular shot in the arm for many of the businesses, even if they're not directly serving the people who are visiting. The exposure is really important, right?
That's absolutely correct, yes. We definitely want to bring the business community together with the residents, and not just in Naugatuck, but the surrounding areas, because the intention of this event when it was created 20 years ago was to have it be a family-friendly and fun event. So it's a little bit of business, it's a little bit of fun. It's a lot of fun, actually. And it involves ducks, so how can you go wrong?
As I was driving from Waterbury down to the studio in Milford this morning along the Naugatuck River and through Naugatuck, I was imagining the sight of 15 or 16,000 yellow rubber ducks getting dumped into the river and hoping that the river has a nice robust flow to carry those ducks to their finish line. Just the sight of that alone is exciting, but this event has really grown over the past 20 years into something that really, as you said, not only kind of consumes the central business district there in Naugatuck, but really the entire region.
Yeah, definitely. It does draw because it is a pretty spectacular sight. There's this iconic photograph that seems to be taken every year. And it's looking from the river edge towards the bridge. And you see this payloader dumped down, like you said, 15,000 ducks. And it's just this stream of yellow that's falling into the river. And then all the kids and adults are just watching it all fall. It's overwhelming to see that in such a good way. And everybody's just watching and watching to see which, you know, is it going to be their duck? Does it have their sticker number that's going to get to the finish line first? And then the prizes are great. I mean, who wouldn't want $5,000 as a first prize in cash? Mm-hmm. And then just to up the ante a little bit this year, because it is our 20th anniversary, we threw in another $5,000 for the last duck that goes to the line, to number 20.
Oh, that's great.
So it pays to be last in this race this year.
and also a ton of great stuff in between. And folks can go...
In between, yeah.
And you guys, you know, it's been around for so long that you guys were genius in getting in on the ground floor to be able to get the internet address, duckday.com, right?
Yes, actually, so a few years back, we started seeing the web addresses being sold like that, and we just kept snatching them up. When they were at a good price, we just kept buying them. So if you just Google Duck Day, it will come up. It's like we're the first ones that come up. It doesn't even matter where you are. We have our web designer was out in Michigan, I believe, earlier this year, and he put in Duck Day, and it came up in Naugatuck, Connecticut.
Excellent.
So, it is internet is a pretty cool thing. but people just call it Duck Day.
Yep.
We can affectionately call it Duck Day. Everybody pretty much knows, oh, Duck Day, yeah, Naugatuck. We know what that is.
Awesome.
So,
well, the main event is Sunday, June 1st from 11 to 4 p.m. with the duck race itself happening a little bit toward the afternoon time. A lot of folks besides you and your event team have been working for weeks now, and that is this unprecedented number of nonprofits. Talk to me a little bit about how the duck race engages and then gives back to these, 70, almost 80 nonprofits that are participating this year?
Yep. So we... always kind of wanted this, in addition of it obviously being in a community event, but we wanted to be able to help nonprofit organizations with a pretty easy fundraiser for each of their organizations and each to be able to support their mission. And it is a 50-50 split. So for every $5 ticket they sell, $2.50 of it goes right back to their organization. And the other $2.50 stays with the chamber to help support economic development for the borough of Naugatuck. So that money is put to good use regardless of whether it's through our efforts or through the, you know, 80-something organizations that have signed up now or in the past. And they love it because now with the added benefit, they can sell physical tickets, they can sell tickets online, they could do both. So there's really the way that it works now is you go onto our website, you go into, you know, ticket sales.
The nonprofit inventory.
The nonprofits, exactly. And then every one of them has a landing page built in. So you go down the list, say you want to support, say, the YMCA, for example. Mm. You just go down, click on YMCA, and it takes you right over to a page, and you can purchase as many tickets as you want and then pay for it right there. And the numbers that we sticker, so to speak, on the ducks are actual stickers. They're not the numbers that are on the tickets that we had printed out. Mm-hmm. So and there's a very good chance. Last year, for example, 3 winners were virtual ticket sellers. So it does work.
Oh, great. Well, the beauty of that is that a philanthropic-minded person with, 25, 50, $100 to spare can go in and actually cherry-pick either thematically the types of nonprofits that mm-hmm. they might want to serve, maybe organizations responding to hunger. So then they can go on and look up and see which one of those organizations do and buy a duck from each one and help each one a little bit. Organizations that support children, organizations that support folks with disabilities, the opportunities and combinations are virtually endless when you're looking at almost 80 participating charities and nonprofits. So that's fantastic. And once again, all you got to do is put Duck Day into any search engine or go to duckday.com or come to duckday.com and you'll go right to the homepage and you can begin to learn about it. Unfortunately, the time has closed for nonprofits to get involved, but it's always great to be looking forward to year 21 and next year to potentially get involved and maybe bring some of your nonprofit participants down to the event to get a feel for it so that it's easier for you to ramp up and start selling Duck Day tickets for next year. The other thing we want to do is, Barbara, give us an idea of the lineup of the day. If folks want to make a day of it and show up bright and early around 11 a.m., what are some of the things they're going to be able to do aside from hanging out and enjoying all of the great developments and things that are happening in downtown Naugatuck?
Sure. So the main festivities are going to be being taken care of up on Maple Street. So that's the downtown area, and that's near the Whittemore Bridge. That's where the main event happens. So between Maple Street, Water Street, a little bit of Old Firehouse Road, everything is going to be closed off completely, pedestrian only, and very safe. We'll be near the fire department. So it's going to be a wonderful way to spend the day. And at 11 o'clock, we actually work with the area schools, K through 5, and even some of the preschools. And they're going to be our superheroes and our ducklings. And the superheroes actually are children that have been monitored throughout the year from their teachers or even some of their peers. And they are the ones that kind of stood out. They kind of went that extra mile, or they really improved, or they were a really good friend to somebody. And they don't know it, but they're going to be nominated and chosen to be a superhero. And then Naga Duck, our mascot, goes to the schools, and that's when the kids find out whether or not they got picked.
Wow.
So they get so excited because they get a backpack, they get a T-shirt saying they're superheroes, they get game passes to go and play all the games. We have a ceremony for them at 11 a.m., and they each get their bag and a retired race duck. And they take a little pledge that they're going to continue to be good young citizens in their school and in their community. And so The Superheroes program is something that the young ones really look forward to. And then last year we actually even had the Ducklings, which are the preschoolers, do a little performance for us. They did a sign language song, and then they got involved. So we like to use the 11 o'clock hour as our really family-focused hour, get the kids there, get the families there. And then they also are recruited, if they're tall enough to go over, look over the bridge, at 12 o'clock we run the corporate duck dash, and those are the businesses that purely enter for bragging rights, and those are the corporate ducks, and they get to toss the big boys into the river, and then we have a first, second, and third placing of the corporate duck race, which starts at 12. And then we get kicked off with live music. This year we have this great regional band called Madhouse. They are a party band known along the whole northeast side, and they wanted to join us this year. So we have Madhouse performing between 12 and 4. Oh, my gosh. We have, of course, food trucks, a marketplace for vendors. We have the Jeep decorating contest is coming back. So that's really fun. All you Jeep owners out there, you can enter your Jeep to have a duck-themed decorated contest. And that is a cash prize for the first one who's chosen as the best decorated Jeep.
Right. I could see all the husbands and wives who are like, why did you get a yellow Jeep? Little sweet revenge, little duck revenge there, right?
Yeah, well, it can be decorated. Majority of it can be whatever they want. We just want it to be duck-themed. But they're only involved the Wranglers and the Gladiators. So it can't be like the other one. So it has to be the true Jeep one, I like to say.
And the Jeeps do not go in the water.
That's the final rule on the Jeep decorating contest. Yeah, they'll be up far away. They'll be up in a parking area and Shaker's Auto Group out of Watertown. They're going to be our sponsors. Fantastic. And they're doing contests in their own showroom, guessing how many ducks are in the Jeep. So that'll be lots of fun.
All right. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, and then our sponsors get to decorate their ducks too, and that's by public opinion of who was the best decorated duck.
So we have a viewing
table for that. They get to duck. Yeah, they get like jumbo ducks, and they get pretty creative with how they want to categorize their business by how they decorate their duck.
Well, I don't want time to run out, because as you mentioned, and it set off a little red flag for me to make sure we got into it a little bit, with the entire kind of borough of Naugatuck Center there off the Maple Street exit of Route 8 being blocked for the main event on June 1st from 11 to 4. Can you give people some of your inside tips on the best way to get into Naugatuck and get parked and over to the festivities as early as 11 a.m. on June 1st?
I could do my best. We actually are going to be meeting with the town at their weekly meetings on Tuesdays. There is some infrastructure construction going on right now. But in the past, when I've looked, in their operating report, like parking, they encourage parking to be where the St. Mary's walk-in lot is. Mm. But there's also two schools that are nearby. They're just two side streets over, off of Meadow Street. So those schools can be also utilized, and I'm just trying to the name.
Yeah, I was going to say. I guess if people go to a map program and just put in something like the Naugatuck train station, they just make sure that they don't get off the Maple Street exit anytime after like 10:30 in the morning on June 1st, then they're not going to get all kind of wrapped up in gridlock, right?
Exactly. Well, that Maple Street exit off of at least Route 8 is going to be closed to foot traffic pretty much early because as soon as we get the food trucks in,
yes,
and the vendors situated, that's their time to shut,
right,
to shut off.
Yeah, we just don't want people to put like the Naugatuck Municipal Hall or the Borough Hall in there,
yeah,
and it takes them, yeah, right to Maple Street, and all of a sudden they're between, yeah, Waterbury or Beacon Falls and Naugatuck, and they hit gridlock.
Exactly.
So
right,
the best thing maybe to target an area outside, like maybe even the Big Y Plaza, and then work your way closer in,
exactly,
to Naugatuck from Union City, or up from Beacon Falls through maybe Rubber Avenue, coming through Middlebury or Oxford, instead of getting Route 8 all the way up into Naugatuck. So a great way to finish that up as our time comes to an end. So Barbara Sarosiak, thank you so much. You're a great representative of the Naugatuck Chamber of Commerce, who is the major organizer for the 20th anniversary Duck Day in downtown Naugatuck. Once again, Sunday, June 1st. All the fun starts at 11 a.m. and goes all the way to 4 p.m. We hope you'll go to duckday.com or web search Duck Day and go to the Naugatuck Duck Day website. Choose your charities and participate as you can to support them by buying ducks, and then come out on June 1st to enjoy the event. It's 38 days, 7 minutes, and 28 seconds away as we record this here on Thursday, the 24th of April. So, Barbara, thanks for participating with us, and best of luck on Duck Day. We'll talk to you again. Thank you. Well, as we mentioned, we are now going to turn to the serious issue of domestic violence. And our friend Suzanne Adam is with us from the Domestic Violence Crisis Center. Since 1980, those angels have provided counseling and advocacy services for victims of domestic violence and their children. They're the only state-certified agency recognized by the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence, serving the communities of Norwalk, Stamford, New Canaan, Darien, Westport, Weston, and Wilton. And as a 100-plus member of the class of 2012, I appreciate the alignment there with the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Great folks there, as well as with all of their network organizations like the DVCC. We're going to talk about that and a lot of important information, and invite you to help support the cause by attending their upcoming luncheon event. We'll tell you all about it right after we remind you about wildfires. Yep. Sad to say, the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, DEEP, is again advising Connecticut residents to take precautions to help minimize the likelihood of fires. Spring is fire season, and it's underway in a big way. DEEP received reports of 40 wildfires just between April 14th and 21st alone. That's burned over 300 acres. Most of these fires can be prevented because they're caused by human actions. And since the start of the year, they've already had calls for 155 fires. That's compared to 77 that were reported in just that same time frame last year. So that's double the number. And these brush fires are serious. They can threaten lives and property. So head to DEEP's website for loads of prevention and safety information and plenty of other resources by visiting portal.ct.gov/DEEP. All right, Suzanne, how are you? Thanks for joining us this morning.
I'm well, thank you, John. I'm so delighted to be here with you today.
So a great event to talk about, but let's get down to business here first. How are things going on with you guys down in Norwalk and Stamford?
Yes, John, things are very busy, but things are going well. Our staff are here to help our community. We are fervent believers that an informed community is a safer community. And as many people are living lives of uncertainty, that simply compounds their experience that they're having at home with abusive partners. So we are ready here to help anyone at any moment in time.
So for folks that aren't familiar with it, but who may very much need your services and support, or for people who think they know someone who does. Just walk us quickly through the dynamics of how folks might be able to specifically engage if they're living in the communities that you serve down in Fairfield County.
Certainly. Domestic violence is about power and control, simply having control over another person. People could use tools such as emotional abuse, physical. Most people think physical abuse. If I'm not being physically abused with black and blue bruises, they're not being an abused individual. However, financial abuse, verbal abuse, technological abuse, using children or immigration over another individual, all of these are tactics to control one person over another. It's most important to understand it's a process. It's not an event. It's not something that happens once and then it goes away. It happens over time. It can escalate. It can de-escalate, but always coming back to the need for someone to have control. Most importantly, as I already stated, that it does not always appear as physical. Abusers simply can use many different tactics, gaslighting, technology, sexual abuse, and financial abuse, which is very common in our area, Lower Fairfield County, to control another person. So that's why DVCC is here to help people make informed choices and decisions that aren't based on fear with what they are experiencing at home.
Well, I know we have been ramping up our attention on financial and technology related forms of domestic abuse. Let's go with financial first, just so people can understand what the implications are, because this is a situation that may not only impact the victim and other family members on an incident-to-incident basis. This is the kind of abuse that can stick with a person, sadly, for many, many years after they have, shed their initial abuser and begun to try to turn a new direction in their lives.
Correct. Financial abuse occurs in 99% of all domestic violence cases. And that's a wild number, but when you think of what happens within financial abuse, it will start to make sense. It's a very effective method for an abuser to maintain control over their partner. If we remember, domestic violence is rooted in power and control. It's totally understandable that controlling someone's finances, their access to money, is one of the most effective ways to keep control over them. Financial abuse can look like sabotaging someone's credit score, keeping PIN numbers to bank accounts from them, making sure people don't have access to their debit cards or credit cards, opening multiple credit cards in someone's name and racking up debt, preventing someone from signing their children up for after-school programs or summer camp. We have seen several different cases lately of abusers withholding food from victims as well. And food insecurity in these times is something that's all too real for many of those we serve. Also, unfortunately, with this type of abuse, it's very hard to get out from underneath it. If a victim stays home to care for their child, they may lack job training or experience or simply earn enough to live independently from their abusive partner. And if victims do leave, they may end up facing homelessness. And as we know, that domestic violence is the leading cause of homelessness for women and children in the United States.
I guess what strikes me as particularly insidious is, withholding or preventing opportunities for victims and especially children to be able to sign up and engage with various types of activities and programs because, in some ways that puts that child in proximity to potentially a mandatory reporter who may end up finding out through that child and may be the first line of defense for that victim, right?
Yes. Very often children possibly could be connected in the crossfires of something physical that could happen. But we do know typically children hear what is happening in the home. They are subtly aware that something is not right. And our counselors and advocates at DVCC work with children to help them understand that abuse is not a normal behavior. We also try to normalize how to identify and express their feelings. We safety plan with children. So if something is happening in the home, they know how to be safer within the dynamics that's taking place, how to go into a room, how to call 911, how to reach out to a trusted adult, how to connect with the siblings or friends who may be in the home at the time. So working both with the non-offending parent as well as working with the children to help them create a safer environment at home is one of the forefronts of the work that we do. And we certainly do collaborate with the Department of Children and Families and working in making sure that all of the children in our communities are safe.
So switching to abuse through technology, you could see where there is a number of crossover points between technology abuse and financial abuse. But what are some other ways that victims can look for the ways that their abuser is utilizing technology to further their abusive behaviors?
I think the simplest way to explain it is everything that is at our fingertips right now to live our lives. Think of our phones that we currently use. We can share our locations. We have iCloud or cloud storage where from one computer to one phone or another device, we can understand and follow our history of what we've been working on. There are GPS systems that people can have access to without even knowing, and tracking systems that people can attach to another individual, sharing locations unbeknownst to someone else. We do have, for example, our website. There is a quick exit. So for an individual who is at the www.dvcct.org website, there is a quick exit. So it will erase your history, and it will also bring you to Google Earth. So an individual who is either looking over your shoulder or trying to check your computer to see what you are doing, that history will be erased, and they will just simply see a search for Google Earth. Technology is all too real, from our cars to our phones to our computers, and abusive partners are getting savvier and savvier using the simple tools we have in our lives to control or intimidate and track, stalk abuse people. And it's our job to stay at the forefront of those technologies to be able to help create safety plans of how to erase history, of how to sometimes even simply take SIM cards out of phones, how to get, you know, you think this is a term for TV, to get a burner phone so you can make simple phone calls without other people understanding or knowing who you're trying to contact. It's a very comprehensive and complicated dynamic. However, our advocates are here to help everyone understand what to think about. We don't even consider how complicated it can be because our lives are right now so reliant on technology. But that very gift that we have with all technology at our fingertips is something that we need to be aware that there are some darker forces that could really harm an individual as they're trying to flee from abuse.
So let's talk about the ways that the public, the folks that are listening to our conversation this morning, can mobilize if they suspect that someone they know or care about or are a coworker with or friend is a victim of abuse.
A couple of things that comes to mind right off the bat is simply to understand that DVCC is here to help people who are experiencing abuse in any kind of way in their personal relationships. Understanding that help is available is the first step to being able to help your community, your friend, your neighbor, your family member, and that we are here to help build a safer environment and create a better well-being for individuals and their families. It's really important for friends, families, not to judge someone who may be experiencing any types of abuse. That will sometimes simply shut down that trusted relationship. And when they do need to reach out again and get that help, they may be reticent because they think they're being judged for the abusive relationship that they may be in. We at DVCC, our goal is to help individuals make informed decisions so they're not making decisions based out of fear. We want and we understand that victims, people in abusive relationships, they simply want the abuse to end. They don't always want the relationship to end. So understanding that dynamic and that reality will really help individuals experiencing abuse. Also understanding that victims, they are experts in their own lives. The most dangerous time for an individual in an abusive relationship is when they attempt to leave. And we do know it takes multiple attempts to leave before they're finally able, if ever, to extricate themselves from that abusive relationship. And also at DVCC, friends, neighbors, understanding that we are here to help through our individual counseling and advocacy, our emergency safe houses, our 24-hour crisis hotlines, to help people build comprehensive solutions. What domestic violence is, it's not an event. It's something that happens. We are parents. We go to work every day. We have friends and family responsibilities. Domestic violence is simply a part of our life. So it's really important that that comprehensive solution is holistic and addresses the entirety of that person's life, not just a moment in time. And so what people can basically do individually, there are lots of ways that we could get help. Donating gift cards, gas cards to DVCC. Our clients, it's a wonderful way for our clients and a great way to help. We have terrific volunteer programs, done of the day projects at both of our safe houses, multiple different ways for people to get involved with the organization and not just simply helping their friends and family.
And coming out to attend your Voices of Courage luncheon, which I understand is coming up soon.
Yes, we are very excited. We have a wonderful event taking place Thursday, May 15th at the Tokeny Club in Darien. We have an incredible speaker. She has a unique story. Her experience will educate both parents, friends, victims, and her story is incredibly powerful. Her name is Ashley Benedictson, and she highlights her incredible resilience. She is a survivor of dating violence, which took place when she was a teen, and she's overcome tremendous challenges from poverty, homelessness, and she uses that as a tool and uses her voice to inspire others. Her journey from homelessness to a valedictorian in college, she uses her pain and her experiences to ultimately empower and support others who are impacted and affected by violence as well. Her personal story will deeply resonate with all of our attendees and show how everyone can really be a part of the solution in breaking the cycle of abuse.
So here, as we broadcast this the last Sunday in April, at this point, the best way for people to get involved is to plan to attend this event and pick up tickets. Let them know a little bit more of the detail about that.
I think the best way to get tickets or to become involved is to go to our website, www.dvcct.org. They're on the top panel, ticker tape, I call it. You'll see a link right there, Voices of Courage Luncheon, and they can just click on that tab and all the details from sponsoring, buying a ticket, donations, and additional information of this incredible speaker is all right there at their fingertips.
And people can also go to dvcct.org to learn about how to donate grocery gift cards and gas cards, or to find out about some of these great volunteer opportunities, many of which are single day projects that folks can do to get involved, but might not have a lot of time. And most importantly, if you are a victim of domestic violence, you should call or text 911 immediately if you can. Otherwise, take advantage of InfoLine here in Connecticut, 211. If you're not within the jurisdiction of DVCC, you're somewhere else within the sound of our voice, even outside of Connecticut, reach out for help. The help is there for you through organizations that are very much like DVCC of Connecticut as well. So I do want to thank Suzanne Adam, the CEO. We hope folks will come out and support this fantastic Voices of Courage luncheon coming up in May, as well as a number of other programs and initiatives over there at the Domestic Violence Crisis Center, serving the greater Norwalk, Stamford region in Fairfield County, and the only affiliate in that region with the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Suzanne, thank you so much for the time and great chat this morning. Best of luck with the event, and we'll talk to you again soon. All right. Well, we're going to wrap our program up with a local voice who we're talking to from a very far away place right now. We're so pleased to welcome Claire Murray, who's co-founder of an organization called CARDI, and they're working to ensure that they celebrate the ingenuity and promise of diverse students across the state by creating opportunities for student artists to learn and grow and to bring art to the people. And we're so pleased to welcome Claire. Claire, we're going to be chatting with you in just a moment. We just want to remind people that more than 60 Naugatuck Valley-based nonprofits, a record number, have signed up to participate in the 2025 Great Give, May 7th and 8th. This 36-hour online fundraising spectacular created by the Community Foundation of Greater New Haven in 2010 unites donors with area nonprofits online in a fun and engaging way. The Great Give raises money and awareness for area nonprofits and causes with valuable matching funds and prizes from the Community Foundation and the Valley Community Foundation and other generous sponsors. If you'd like to donate to your favorite nonprofit or nonprofits during the Great Give, then just go to thegreatgive.org between 8 a.m. on May 7th and 8 p.m. on May 8th. All right. So I have never done an interview with somebody in Paraguay before, but Claire Murray has joined us there where she is working on her doctoral degree. And Claire, thanks for joining us on the program. Glad we finally got a hold of you.
Thank you so much, John. Thrilled to be here, thrilled to chat about CARDI and everything that we've been collaborating on.
So I know you mentioned it briefly before we turned on the call this morning, but is your work that you're doing right now in Paraguay in some way going to feed into CARDI and what you're doing here in Connecticut with your team?
We talk about CARDI in this way that we're an art museum bus designed with, by, and for kids across Connecticut. And inherently that puts community, it puts this sense of belonging at the heart of everything we do. We want to make sure through CARDI, young kids across our state, especially those with limited access, know and feel that they belong and are invited and are meant to take advantage of everything that museums have to offer. My work done here at Paraguay is looking at a museum that is doing much the same, but from a place where museum going, museum building is not a tradition. And the way in which this museum that I'm studying down here is going about building the infrastructure, the potential for a culture of museum going is by centering children. And for me, there's nothing more interesting and captivating and intellectually stimulating than thinking about how we can center children's voice, children's material culture in our museum world, in our museum's field, and really elevate the fact that children matter. And we need to do everything we can, not just because they're the future, right? But because right here, right now, today, the present, children matter. And as museums, as institutions that are meant for community, that are meant for everyone, we have to do what we can to push the grain that we're not just elite institutions, we're places for everyone.
So do you think your experiences in Paraguay will become part of the narrative that you discuss as you're introducing CARDI to your youth audiences and others here in Connecticut?
I think Paraguay is a country that is not talked about enough. So I will forever, moving forward in my life, make it a point to bring attention, right? I mean, so much of our conversations about art history, there's so much focus on the Western world and changing the narrative territorially, right, to think about more than just the colonial vision or whatnot is critical. So I do know for sure, I will be talking about just my life here with kids back in Connecticut, but even more than that, the promise of developing a museum with kids, that's something that transcends borders. It transcends culture. It's something that we can do everywhere, and particularly back in Connecticut, we have a lot more work to do with Cardi. So far, right, in the past 4 years, we've grown our following, our impact. Originally, we started up in the pandemic, and we were able to serve 7 schools. We were able to form 7 school partnerships. Right now, we're over 40. We're reaching over 7,000 pre-K through second grade students every year, and we're seeing those students multiple times. Right, we're kind of weaving this model of art museum enrichment into the traditional school approach. And like I said, there's a lot more to do. 7,000 kiddos is not nearly getting close to the 109,000 plus that we've got in Connecticut. So it's critical that we keep moving and that we keep this vision alive. And every day, every kiddo more, we've got to celebrate that. And know, though, that there's a lot more ahead.
So was the Cardi concept already on the drawing board when COVID hit back in 2020?
Yeah, believe it or not, it was. but COVID was somewhat of a blessing. It gave us time to pause. And at the time I was in grad school, when COVID hit, right? And there was no way that amidst everything, amidst everyone else's responsibilities at our founding board, there's no way we were going to be able to actually give founding a nonprofit the amount of time and energy it needed while we were balancing so many other things. But COVID gave us this pause and kind of this opportunity to think a little bit more critically what matters. And it also gave us the time to build relationships, right? We're only able to fuel Cardi to drive the extra mile because of donations. Being a nonprofit, we're run on donations. And we needed that time, that pause of COVID to really build relationships. You know, all of us come from humble backgrounds, and to dream up Cardi did mean connecting with folks who have the means. And it still means connecting with folks who have the means. Every mile more we want to drive, that's more fundraising we need to do. So the idea for Cardi, it came about probably about 10 years ago, though. I co-founded Cardi with my mom, who's an early childhood educator, has been for all of my life. And she's just, her brain is wild, right? She just knows children. And I fell in love with museums. She and I, in different ways, though, I will take some credit. I definitely did convince her to do some volunteer work with me at a museum, a children's museum, one summer. And it was a chance when the both of us were able to put our professional interests together, and we just had so much fun. And it was in that environment, that space for creativity, right? Children's museums, we know, we love. It gave us the opportunity to be playful about the promise of early childhood museum education. And we thought up what if we could bring our unique skill sets together and so many more, and think about our home state. Connecticut has huge inequities, right? You drive from one town 20 minutes down the road, opportunities, resources can be a total 180. And what if we could think about this promise of early childhood art and museum education as something that could transcend and really confront these stark inequities? What if it could be inside of, well, a bus that could travel directly to schools, could travel directly to community centers? And so the idea, it was, you know, the seed was planted, let's say, 10 years ago. But it definitely took some time incubating and talking with more people. And you know, you study creativity research, the first idea that comes to us isn't always the most creative, right? It isn't always the one that's going to have the most promise. But that first idea, it was the seed that meant so much. And with the persistence and the care and the passion that has kept the idea going, the idea has only gotten more authentic to what Connecticut needs, right? Like by talking to more and more school teachers, by talking to more and more students, by talking to more and more stakeholders in our state, what are the direct needs? What are the direct interests? And how can Cardi be aligned and tailored specifically to meet that.
Well, it was probably around 20 years ago when we really started to see school systems and schools begin to cut back on things like music and art programs. But it was around 10 years ago when this idea came to you that we started really seeing the impact of the loss of those creative, enriching, imagination-driven types of curriculum. So the idea came at the right time. And it's not just this mobile gallery and classroom that travels around, but it really also supports student artists in a number of ways. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Yes. So critical to Cardi is that we're an art museum, right, designed with, by, and for kids. Every single work of art inside of our art museum bus is made by Connecticut middle and high school students. And there's a really important and integral reason for that. You know, when we go to museums, you or I, and we're getting to know a work of art, we're curious about who the artist is, right? And so often we think about the artists on the walls inside of museums as masters. Well, what if, as a young kiddo, you were looking at a work of art and there's that association of the work on the wall, it's really, really prized. What if that artist was someone who looked like you? What if that artist was someone who's from the same town as you? What if that artist is someone who you relate to? And so for Cardi, there's three really, really big and important participants and audiences that we want to be reaching. One is obviously the young kiddos, right? We want to make sure every young kiddo in our state has a really positive and prolonged early experiences with art and museum education. The next big audience, big participant group is emerging student artists. And those are middle and high school student artists who have this passion for art already, who have had the growing up and the to go ahead and forge their path and be bold about the art they want to make and to take the risk of submitting some art to a call for art. Those same student artists through Cardi have an opportunity to not only have their art exhibited inside of a museum gallery, but to have really powerful and intimate internships within the art nonprofit space. Those same student artists have opportunities to develop their leadership skills, their social skills, by being members of our student advisory board and helping us annually set the tone, the theme for our exhibitions. And then that third audience group is the wider community. We recognize, right, if kids are at the center of all of our work, kids at school, that's just one portion of kids, right? And there's family life, there's community life. And for us, it's really important to recognize that going to a museum isn't just something that needs to be associated with schools, with formal education. It needs to be associated with our daily lives, our wellness, our opportunity to just be and experience the world. And so through those three audience groups, those participant groups, we want to be doing everything we can, giving all the opportunities we can, and continuously adapting based on needs, based on abilities, based on interests.
Very good. Well, I hope that the next time we meet, Claire, it will be actually on the Cardi bus, and we'll be able to do a For the People segment right there while talking to some of the young people who are engaging through the great work that you do. In the meantime, if you heard something that's appealing to you and you'd like to help fuel the Cardi movement, you can go to their website and hit the donate button right up at the top, or you could learn all about what they do and maybe arrange for them to participate in an event in your community, at your school, in your neighborhood, or with your group through these exciting art and museum adventures. Claire Murray is the co-founder of Cardi, Cartie.org. Cardi.org is their website. And Claire, thank you so much for your time today. Best of luck in the balance of your time in Uruguay. And we hope to talk to you again once you get the bus rolling in a couple of months and sort of do the second part of this interview. So thank you for now and travel safe. And we'll see you back here in Connecticut. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a PSA for our program that's relevant to the audiences and communities we serve, you must make your request for consideration in writing via email to john.vocat@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program can be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station websites. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs John Vocat. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime. Just find it under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.
Since 2011, American Giant has been making everyday clothing with extraordinary effort. Not in far-off factories, but right here in the USA. We obsess over fabrics, fit, and details, because if you're going to wear it every day, it should feel great and last for years. From the cut of a hoodie to the finishing of a seam, nothing is overlooked. Our supply chain is tight-knit and local, which means less crisscrossing the country and more care in every step. The result is durable clothing, t-shirts, hoodies, sweatpants, and denim that become part of your life season after season. This isn't fast fashion. It's clothing made with purpose by people who care as much about how it's made as how it fits. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.